You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
The night has become electrified. Mid-evening, May comes to my room. The turn of doorknob, click of bolt in hasp. The opening door casts a wedge of yellow hall light against the wall. Her slender, dark hand twists the switch and closes the door. Not a word spoken. The brutal light is message enough. A clear glass bulb hangs in the center of the room from a cord of brown woven cloth. New wires run down the wall in an ugly metal conduit. The bare bulb's little blazing filament burns an angry cloverleaf shape onto my eyeballs that will last until dawn. It's either get up and shut off the electricity and light a candle to read by, or else be blinded. I get up and turn off the light.
Charles Frazier won the National Book Award in 1997 for his first novel, Cold Mountain. His new novel is 13 Moons. Welcome to the program, Charles.
Thank you.
Charles, your new novel is a novel of change across a big chunk of time, and you have a lot of really interesting perceptions of this change. So, first off, could you set up the story for us? It's about a man you call Will Cupper.
It starts out when Will is about 12 years old. He's been sent out as a bound boy to run a trading post at the edge of Indian Territory. This is in the early 19th century. He's adopted into that small group of Cherokee, and from that point forward, for most of a century, his life is tied up with the life of this group of people.
One of the things that interests me is the different ways we perceive change, and you show this so well in the book, at different ages in our lives. Tell me a little bit about how you discovered that in yourself and how you conveyed that in your words.
Well, I mean, there's a lot about change in Will's life in this book, and also a lot about change in the life of the country. Over the span of his life, he goes from being a very innocent kid living way out at the edge of the wilderness in what was frontier in America at that time, right along the crest of the Blue Ridge Mountains, goes from there to being able to handle himself as a lobbyist in Washington, a colonel in the Civil War, a white chief of the Cherokee, and also a senator. So he has to make a lot of changes. And the country at the time was going through enormous changes as the native peoples were, as their cultures were being threatened with extinction, and our culture was covering the continent.
One of the things that interests me about this book is the way that one of the focal points of the book is the Trail of Tears, but it happens off stage, and I'm wondering, why did you make the decision to do it that way?
When there were stockades that the Indians were collected into and then sent from the stockades out to Indian Territory on the Trail of Tears, and the last you see of it in the book is as the stockade doors open and they leave, it felt to me like that was not my story to tell. Once it left my piece of country, the territory where I grew up, and the story I was trying to tell focused on that little piece of the world, then it felt like that was somebody else's story to go into from that point forward.
Let's ratchet back a little bit. Your first novel, Cold Mountain, was drawn largely from your family, was it not? Is that the case?
Yeah, there was the origin of that book was in a little bit of family history.
Tell me a little bit about that piece of family history.
Well, my father was working, he had recently retired at that point and was working on a family history, and I was home visiting one weekend, and he told me this story about a great-great uncle who had been wounded badly near Petersburg and had walked home rather than go back to fighting once he had healed up some, and then was killed in a gunfight with the home guard when he got back. So within just a matter of days, I was starting to think about what kind of novel that might make and put some pieces together and begin writing some little bits to see what it would be like. And it felt like a felt like a very basic outline for a novel, and I just moved forward from there.
One of the things you did with that novel that was really interesting is to layer two different types of myths. The Greek myth of Odysseus, there's an Odyssean Odyssey feel to this, but also the myths of our understanding of the Civil War. And tell me a little bit about how it felt to mingle those two as you wrote and researched.
Well, the Odyssey element of the book was partly just my way of feeling comfortable with writing about the Civil War, because I'm not enormously interested in the Civil War, in the battles and generals and all that strategy. But once I realized that the book I was going to write was going to be an Odyssey instead of an Iliad, it was about leaving the war and trying to find home and peace instead of fighting the war, then I felt like I could move forward with it. The other element of the question involves the American mythology of the Civil War. And that's something that's always interested me and that I find fairly off-putting, that kind of glamorization of Lee and Stonewall Jackson, you know, just the fact that there's a shrine to Stonewall Jackson's amputated arm is, in this kind of religious relic kind of thing in Virginia. I've always found that odd and amusing, and didn't want any of that kind of romanticizing and mythologizing of the Civil War and its leaders in my book.
With your new book, 13 Moons, is it based on a family history, or is this something you had to? How did it feel to do something different, if indeed you did something different?
Well, it's based on a bit of local history from where I grew up. Lots of people know about the Trail of Tears, but I think it's not as well known that there was this small group of Cherokee who managed to resist being removed, and they were the beginning of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. They kept their home, they're still there, and those people have been my neighbors since I was a kid. So I wanted partly to tell the story of how they came to remain there.
And when you started doing this, how did you undertake to research this book?
Oh, lots of different ways. One of the things, this involved a good bit of primary documents, of going to army reports and things like that. Like, for example, every Cherokee household that was emptied out of its people, every little farm, the army kept records of all their possessions, all the way down to how many spoons they owned. So you could go farm by farm and look at this accounting of all their possessions and have a sense of the life in that place from the material culture of the place. And I realized when I looked at it that the Cherokee at that time were living almost identically to my ancestors 50 miles away.
That's one of the fascinating things about this novel, is the portrait of the Cherokee. They live like the rich, the best of them live like the rich white owners with huge plantations and houses.
Yeah, there were Cherokee people on the Cherokee Nation who owned plantations that were as fine as anything in Georgia or Alabama or Mississippi, owned slaves. A significant percentage of people on the Trail of Tears were African Americans.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So where did you find these primary sources? I mean, where, when you found these army accountings, where did you find them? In your local libraries, or...?
I think that particular thing I found in the rare books room at University of North Carolina. I do a lot of work in North Carolina libraries.
In North Carolina, presumably, is where you reside.
Yeah, part of the year.
One of the things that I found really interesting is the way you work in the historical figures into this. They don't figure at the center of the picture, but you work them in nicely on the side. So tell me a little bit about how you mix the fictional and the non-fictional and how you decide what proportion of what gets where.
Well, it's one of those difficult decisions in a way, of how to use the historical material and to what extent you're bound by it. But I pretty much work off the proposition that my first obligation is to the fictional world, to the story, the characters, the settings, and that the history is just a background for that, and that I will change history if I need to for the good of the story. I try not to, but I was doing a sort of a class at the Smithsonian Institute on historical fiction a few years ago, and a woman said, stood up and asked a question, said she thought that she knew, or that her husband thought he knew where in Cold Mountain I started making things up. The exact page, she said. And I said, well, I'll tell you where I started making things up, and then you tell me where your husband thinks I started making things up. And I said, I started on page one. I'm a novelist. And she said, well, never mind.
One of the things I think you do really well is to create a world that's very different from ours. It's almost like an alien world. Everything is completely different. And I wonder if you'd care to talk about this process of building a world out of prose that's not ours, yet our world is that future.
Yeah, I mean, when you're writing a historical novel, that's part of what you're doing, is creating this world that I don't know directly. Nobody in the audience knows directly. My goal is to make it feel real. But I tend to think of it almost like writing a science fiction novel, that you're developing this world. You want to make it have really thick texture. You want people to believe it, but it's a creation. You're trying to make a reader believe this world that you're just creating out of imagination and some historical research.
It's interesting that you mentioned science fiction, because that's, in a way, that's how it read to me, in because of some of the surreal and supernatural touches that you pour in to this world. And I'd like to ask you about those. Of course, the one that stands out is Granny Squirrel. She's a really fascinating character. Tell us a little bit about how you created this character, who she is within the book.
Yeah, she's a Cherokee healer who claims she's really, really old, a couple of hundred years old. And she's based on a good bit of reading about Cherokee spiritualism, Cherokee medicine, those kinds of things. And little things like one of the first times that a census was taken of the Cherokee, there were several people who claimed to be 200 years old. So that gave me the start of Granny Squirrel as a 200-year-old woman.
It's really fascinating. And you also people this world with giant lizards, huge leeches in the creeks. Did you find all these legends in the stuff you looked at, or did you create them?
Those two things are Cherokee folklore, myth and legend. But when I was a kid, the valley where I grew up, the river that ran through the valley, there was a deep hole in the river that the Cherokee believed this giant leech the size of an oxen lived down there in that hole. And there was a bald on top of one of the mountains, which is just a mountaintop with no trees growing on it, and they're sort of mysterious places. And the Cherokee believed that there was a giant lizard that lived on the bald that I could see from my backyard when I was a kid.
When you're creating these kind of supernatural, and there's also some really interesting surreal touches too. There's a scene where two people walk into Will's store and they just look at him and they don't say anything. Did this happen to you in some previous life?
I don't remember where that scene came from, other than I was probably thinking about. I used to go to Peru a lot and do treks up in the Andes, and I just remember the awkwardness of trying to communicate with people with people who spoke Quechua and a little bit of Spanish, and I spoke English and a little bit of Spanish, and how often these awkward silences ensued.
That brings to mind the subject of language, which is central to this novel. Tell us a little bit about what a syllabary is.
Well, the Cherokee syllabary was developed by Sequoia, and he analyzed the language and realized that if he made a symbol for each sound of the language, that people who already knew the language just had to match the symbols with the sounds to become literate. And it was an amazing thing that people in the Cherokee Nation went from being illiterate to literate in 2 or 3 days. And within months, people all over the Cherokee Nation were able to read their own newspaper that they printed. They wrote letters back and forth to each other. It was a brilliant and amazing piece of work that he did.
It creates a phenomenal change in the civilization, too. And this gets back to the passage of time, because when you can write things down, you can fix that time, that moment of time, yeah. And it doesn't change. So how did this change the Cherokee civilization?
Well, you know, I think that Bear, at some point in the book, the character Bear, who's the adopted father of Will Cooper, talks about stories and history, and that that history is just stories. Somebody gets to make it up, and when you go from an oral tradition to a written tradition, the transmission of those stories changes, and that's part of what I was working with the syllabary, and then Bear is an oral storyteller.
And you have a lot of fun with the writers and the stories and the versions of stories that happen, in particular Charlie's story, and also later on in the novel when various writers approach Will as he's approaching his dotage. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this, you know, a game of telephone, essentially.
Well, after the conclusion of the Charlie story, which is a very important story to the Eastern Band of Cherokee, it's part of how they came to stay there. This man and his family agreeing to come down they'd been hiding in the mountains, resisting the removal on the Trail of Tears, ended up killing some soldiers. And finally, there was a deal struck that if they would come down and the men would be executed, then other elements of the Eastern Band could stay. And that story has been told in many different ways. It's been mythologized. It's been told as a kind of savior sacrifice story. In the book, Will and Bear have this conversation where they realize that somebody is gonna tell that story, and that it's gonna shape the way it's seen in the future, and they decide that it doesn't exactly matter if they get all the details right, as long as it makes a good story. And so they make up a good story, and then that's what they tell to journalists who come through wanting to know about it.
And this, of course, is a microcosm for your process of making the novel itself.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the Eastern Cherokee, because it's a very fascinating story that, as you say, most of us, I sure as heck didn't know anything about it, about how they came to hold their land.
Yeah, it was a wonderful irony. The ancestors, the origin of the Eastern Band, were the most traditional, the most full-blood Cherokee. Over on the Cherokee Nation, they were living just off the nation. Over on the Cherokee Nation, you had those Cherokee that owned slaves and plantations and were more Scotch than they were Indian. But by this odd little quirk of history, the most traditional of the Cherokee found a way to stay, and the most assimilated were sent off to the territories. And the key to it was this very alien concept of ownership of property. Private ownership of property was not a part of Cherokee culture. But the leader of this group of Cherokee understood that he could make it work to their advantage.
There really was an analog to Will Cupper. And tell us a little bit about this man and how you transformed him into Will and what you did to make your story.
Yeah, a guy named William Holland Thomas, who went out into Indian territory at age 12 or 13, and his life was tied up with the Indians for many decades afterwards. So I used bits and pieces of his life. The very bare outline of my character's life follows William Holland Thomas's. All the empty spaces in there I filled up with made-up stuff.
Now, was there really this complicated set of deeds and land ownership that you describe in the book? Because it's really interesting, and it leads to one of the changes, the way that commerce itself is as a kind of technology. And this gets back to this science fictional aspect of this book that I find really interesting, is that you portray the coming of a new technology and how people who have never encountered it before use it to their advantage.
The traditional Cherokee value was that the land was owned by everybody. Or not even owned, that's the wrong word to use. That you used what you needed. You didn't own it, you used it. And what was defined as need was pretty limited. You know, a little cabin, an orchard, some kitchen gardens. And then Europeans came along, settlers came along with this notion of owning property, having deeds, applying the legal system to land itself. The Cherokee, a lot of Native American groups had a hard time with that concept for that period of first contact with European cultures. But there was a leader of the Eastern Band of Cherokee named Yanaguska, and he understood that while it was a foolish notion that they could use private property, the ownership of private property, to their advantage if they held deeds to their land, then maybe they would get to stay.
One of the things you also talk about is the swamp that was really never been drained to this day, and that's Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Tell us a little. Will makes a trip up there in the 1830s when Washington was very much a work in progress, a very muddy, messy, raw kind of town. He loves a lot about the excitement of it and hates a lot of it too. Ends up in the White House with a little confrontation with Andrew Jackson.
I mean, the way business was conducted back then, it's really not that different from the way it is now. and I found it fascinating. Did you looked into that, presumably? I mean, tell us, where did you find that information?
Oh, I read all kinds of things. Letters and journals of people who were in Washington at that time, travelers who passed through Washington. I remember a particularly good book of either journals or letters by the wife of a senator, just talking about the social life of Washington at that period. All of that kind of thing helps you build that texture of a created historical place and time.
Books and reading also play a great part in this novel. Will is a great reader. He's always got books. He's always reading books. And he's also very interested in stories, and this comes back to when he and Bear create the story of Charlie. So, but I find it kind of interesting that a 12-year-old kid could get books. Did his namesake get books up there, or?
I'm sure that he did. I guess the origin of that of a kid way back in the back country being able to get the complete plays of Shakespeare and romantic poets and all that was another one of those little bits of research. I found the inventory of a trading post and was amazed that along with things like plow points and just bits of horse tack and tools and implements, that this store also sold an awful lot of French champagne and had quite a collection of books for sale.
Wow, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, it wasn't what I expected.
I wouldn't imagine. And this gets down to some of the things of one of the ways that you make this book really wonderful are all the details. First off, have you eaten rattlesnake? Does it really taste like chicken?
I have not eaten rattlesnake. The last time I was around cooked rattlesnake, I wasn't entirely sure of how it had been kept before it was cooked. But somebody who was eating it said, "Yep, they say it tastes like chicken, and it does."
Well, you have lots of interesting details. For example, there's just gorgeous, almost poetic passages describing the different kinds of money that people had back then. We live in a culture where everybody has, either money, one kind of money or checks. So it's interesting to see the variety of money. Where did you learn about all that?
Oh, just more of that going to the library, thinking about that time and place, that the states had their own money, that silver and gold was valuable whether it was from Europe or South America or wherever, and that people used anything, any kind of current, any kind of money that was of value. I loved finding out that silver piece of money or gold would be cut into pieces.
That was really interesting.
Then it would be like an eighth of a whatever, or just little pieces of it would be currency as well.
And while we're speaking of pieces of things, the other thing that I found really interesting was the way that racial divisions were perceived back then. It was scary. So yeah. Tell us a little bit about how that worked.
Well, in many states in the South, there were legal distinctions for racial quantities down to 1/32nd. There were words for amount of dark blood all the way down to 1/32nd, and defining anybody who had elements of Native American or African American blood as non-white all the way down to those fine fractions. And I was interested in those issues of racial identity, cultural identity, and the changes that were happening at the time related to those.
Well, and it was also interesting, you brought this up a little bit earlier, but I want to pursue it, the idea that many of the Indians were actually largely Scottish, Irish.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, that little bit of the Southern Appalachians, Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, North Georgia, a lot of Scott traders came up from Charleston to do business with the Cherokee in the early 18th century, and many of those Scott traders then had what they call country wives, and over time you ended up with a situation where the head chief of the Cherokee, the whole Cherokee nation at the time of removal, was three-fourths Scott, didn't speak Cherokee, didn't like to be around people who did speak Cherokee because it made him uncomfortable.
With all these details that you create, and as you're weaving this world with your language, one of the things you do very well is you'll present us with a beautifully poetic piece of description. And what happens is we start to see the present percolating up through the past as you describe it. And I want to know, does that happen? As you start out the passage, do you think this passage is going to have a point, or do you discover that as you write?
Oh, I rarely have a plan when I write. And I don't know. I know writers who, by the time they have an outline for a book, they're three quarters of the way done. It's such a detailed thing. My sense is I like to discover everything as I'm working, and if I've got a handful of things that I know I want to be in a book, then every paragraph is, I'm out there in my office finding out what's going to happen in that paragraph.
So you don't outline your books, or
no?
Okay,
I know with Cold Mountain I had five things that I knew were parts of what had happened to that ancestor of mine, and that made a story. With this one, I knew about four or five things that I knew I wanted to cover: the removal of the Cherokee and the Charlie story, being the central element of it. But then I just want to find that, let these connections just happen as the book evolves. Because it takes me a long time to write a book, so there's plenty of time for that to happen.
It seems that you have this world that you just have a lot of fun exploring.
Well, I love the research part of it. I mean, research is sort of an odd word to use for spending a day in the library, reading about interesting things. I'd say a good half of what I collect in that kind of work never gets used in the book. I enjoy it, and it's a very, very inefficient process for me.
Tell us a little bit about, I want to get back to this idea of technology and change, because you that seems to be a very strong theme in here. And there's different, what's interesting is that the things that these people, the people in this book, perceive as technology, we don't even nearly rise to that level for us. And so I'm wondering how you manage to create within yourself the ability to perceive something as, a technology, something as somewhat foreign and unfamiliar that to us is beneath notice almost.
Oh, like, Give me an example.
Well, like some of the idea of commerce, the way they deal with the money,
yeah.
And even accounting.
Well, a lot of that is just thinking about the kind of life, a kind of subsistence life, where money doesn't really enter into it very much. That if you're living on a little farm, and you're raising or hunting for and gathering almost everything you need to live, then money and all the things that go with money aren't really a significant feature of your thinking or your day-to-day life. And so it's just sort of trying to get yourself into that kind of frame of mind and that set of values. And it's hard for any of us to do that now.
One of the things that this novel seems to do is it addresses a lot of issues and ideas that we're exploring today, right now. And there's this sense of the present percolating up out of the past. And I'm wondering, is that something you discover, or do you, once you kind of sense get the scent, do you follow that?
Well, to some degree, but I think it's just fairly natural that a writer working on a historical novel, a novel set in the past, that the book is really going to be as much about now as about then, because that's your now is your world. That's the world you know. That, I mean, it always has felt to me like, for example, Scarlet Letter, that the big historical novels of American literature are as much about the time they were written, and in that case, the 1860s, as about the Puritan past of the 17th century.
And this is in much the way, when you talk to science fiction writers, many of them will say the same thing, that it's set in the future, but it's really about the present.
Yeah.
And this gets back to that. One thing that I found kind of interesting was this idea of how civilized the Indians were, with the houses, the tea trays, the settings. Yeah. I mean, they were living at this idea of the noble savage, which you talk a little bit about. That's even at that point, that was largely erased, wasn't it?
Yeah, at the time this book begins, the Cherokee had been in contact with white people for going on a couple of centuries, and much of their culture was rapidly disappearing. The clan system was really fading fast. Their justice system, which was part of the clan system, was falling apart, and they were very quickly adopting our ways, largely with the understanding, and they'd been told this by Washington and Jefferson and other presidents, that the way for them to continue to live where they lived was to become as much like us as possible. And they had become a great deal like us, and we still decided we couldn't live alongside them.
One of the pulls through both your novels are love stories. And I'm wondering how you, as a writer, develop this as a pulling mechanism to pull the reader and pull the character through, and how you place that love story in the historical context and make sure that it develops in a manner that works within the story and the history.
I'm always interested in characters who are yearning for a connection, for connections with place, with community, with other people, with, you know, and love is just the primary one of those yearnings. And Will is, Will's got responsibilities to this group of people. He's got a great deal of feeling for them. And he's also got this very personal connection to a woman named Claire that he's known since he was 12. And in a lot of cases, those two kinds of yearning are in conflict with each other. His responsibilities to the people that he feels obligated to, and his own personal sense of just wanting to be with Claire.
Your novels also really inhabit a landscape, and the landscape that they move through, that your characters move through, is itself a character within the novel. And presumably this is where you live, and you spend a lot of time connected with your landscape. So tell me, how do you draw your own personal connections to the landscape within which you live, which is also undergoing a lot of change,
yeah,
with the landscapes that you portray back in history?
Well, I mean, I love books that have a real sense of place, a really thick texture of place. And my place is Western North Carolina, the Southern Appalachians. I was born there, still live there. So I just try to be as local as I can be in developing a novel. The natural history, the human history, all of those elements that make a place.
You've certainly created places that will live in many people's memory. We've been speaking with Charles Fraser. His new novel is 13 Moons. Thank you for joining me, Charles.
Thank you.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.